Everyone, we have three items before us. First, we'll review any subcommittee recommendations. Then we'll look at any potential proposals that committee members might be entertaining. We won't have a full-blown hearing, but at least have a chance to discuss any items that you may be advocating next session. And if there's written proposals, do that as well. Finally, we're going to look at the Permanent School Trust Fund. As you recall, in August, we had a tour in northern Minnesota to get a firsthand look at the trust lands, the primary part of the trust lands. We had a chance to have dialogue with officials on that, and since that time, the School Boards Association has put together some recommendations. The House has actually a special working group that is going to be meeting with us later in the meeting to talk about some suggestions. So in that spirit of collaboration, we'll meet, and Representative Dietrich is the chair of that House group, and they'll be joining us later in the meeting. Any questions on the agenda? Okay, first we'll go to subcommittee recommendations and ask Senator Bonoff on early childhood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. We have been meeting. We've had a series of hearings this fall jointly with the House Early Childhood Committee. We first met on October 9th at the Way to Grow Center in Minneapolis. We met on November 13th at the Winnetka Learning Center, and we met on December 11th at the First Presbyterian Church in St. James. And it's been our intention to work jointly with the House so that we come to some agreement among those who care deeply about the early childhood issues, so that when we present a recommendation at the legislature this session, we believe we will have the best opportunity to actually make something happen. Because of that, we also want to include those early childhood members of the Early Childhood Caucus. So today I'll be letting you know about what we found at each of our hearings and some of the recommendations or thoughts about those hearings, but we are not going to be presenting our final recommendations until we've had on January 17th, there will be the Early Childhood Caucus Leaders Retreat, where we'll actually be spending a half a day on this subject. And so until this whole group has come together to discuss our findings and our thinking, we will refrain from giving a final recommendation. The way we approached the early childhood issues is looking at it with really three spans of early childhood development. In the first hearing, we looked at the 0 to 3 years, and we had different people talk about how they approached, in North Minneapolis, the at-risk kids from prenatal to age 3. And there was agreement across the board that the government needs to play some role in empowering parents of at-risk children. What we found is that home visiting seemed to be the most effective approach to supporting children at risk and ensuring parental involvement. And we heard from many different groups who were working in partnership with the early childhood providers to go into the home and make sure this was happening. And I know there's been some disagreement among the early childhood community, is this our role? But what we found is that unless you go to where the parents are, that the parents are key to making sure these kids are on the path to being ready, and that unless we can intervene and provide the empowerment and the help to the parents, we aren't going to be effective. The second hearing, which dealt with increasing kindergarten preparedness of high-risk children, was in Robbinsdale. And we chose Robbinsdale because in Robbinsdale, they have such a huge population of English language learner preschool children. And they are doing a phenomenal job of providing family literacy. They're not looking at just the child, but they've realized how important it is to be reaching out to those parents and making sure that they are learning English and that they're on the road to being productive and having jobs. And so their approach is an overall umbrella family approach. And we saw how successful that was. We also saw how important public-private partnerships are. And that's been a theme running through this. Because we don't have a formal system in Minnesota, a formal early childhood education system, we have developed these public-private partnerships, whether they be in the Head Start or the community-based, faith-based. These various community organizations have come together, reaching out to the families and then working with the school districts to make sure they're doing what they need to make sure these kids are ready for school. It has been stressed, particularly at this hearing, how important parental choice is. Parents do want to decide where their children are educated. We did hear a desire for both scholarships and program appropriations. I think there's been some debate. Should we be giving our resources directly to the families and to the parents so they have choice, or should we be making sure that we have the institutions and the programs out there that can handle it? And the consensus is that both are important and that we do need to be looking at both. And then the last hearing, which was dealing with the increasing preparedness for first grade in St. James, was very interesting. They have a consortium of public-private partnership organizations that have come together to make sure that they're serving the needs of every child in that community, and we were very inspired by how they have taken this on. They're working with the school district to make sure that the curriculum is exactly what they're looking for. We were impressed that that this community is taking charge of this transition period and that schools and early care and education programs are working well. They stress the importance of collaboration and that they have foundations that have raised money to make this happen. Unfortunately, those foundations are not going to be able to do this indefinitely. And so while these collaborations are key to reaching these children, they have let us know that it's important for this state to have a role in keeping this going as well. And so I think what the conclusions have been to this point is that there is a role for the state to play in an expanded way, and that it's important to approach this from a community perspective, and that the real key questions are, what is the best delivery method? How can we best get our financial resources to the people who are making a difference? How do we make sure that they are held accountable for making the difference that we're charging them with? And how can we empower families? And so at our next retreat, those will be the questions that we'll be wrestling with. And we have very, you know, I know Senator Olson's been there, Senator Torres-Ray. We have heated discussions about what is the best approach to tackling this. And I look forward to hearing the consensus that will develop within the caucus, the House, and our group.
Thank you, Senator Bonner.
I'm happy to take questions.
Questions. And very thorough report, and
Thank you.
Really taken the message on the road, and look forward to the upcoming retreat, I guess, that you're going to have. Is there anything that you're able to forecast as to what you believe might be in recommendations for 08?
I think that that our recommendations will look at I hate to prejudge that, because the questions that we look at, even though we know that birth to three is so important, with limited dollars, are we better off using our resources with the 3 and 4 year olds? And I think that will be kind of the balance that we'll be looking at. And then within that 3 and 4 year old, how do we divide our approach between empowering the family and the programs? And so I think that our recommendation will deal with answering those questions. And I've actually assured my House counterparts that before we let you know where we're going to go on this, that we allow them to be at the table with us. So I'd rather wait.
Okay. Further comments or questions? Thank you, Senator Bonner. We'll, in order, go with transportation next. If there's a request where you need to be away for a bit or want us to take it out of order, let me know as well, and we'll accommodate that. Otherwise, we'll go to the transportation report.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would like to address that. We've had a couple of meetings, and November 30th, we had a pretty heart-wrenching meeting when we had Amanda Berglund. Her parents came in and testified. She was a girl who was killed when the minivan in which she was being transported home plowed into the back of a school bus. And it was very compelling testimony from the parents. They didn't realize that the person operating this Type 3 vehicle was not a school district employee. And so they felt they had some questions about this driver. He'd been transporting their daughter for a number of months, I guess. But they felt as long as he's a school district employee, it must be okay. And so that has really highlighted some of the problems we're having with these Type 3 vehicles. And from their testimony and testimony from Captain Urquhart from the State Patrol, I think it's clearer that we need to go in a direction of addressing who's operating these Type 3 vehicles and who's transporting our children. But also, Captain Urquhart really stressed to us that the buses are safe. With the inspection programs that are going on, the vehicles are inspected on an annual basis, and the brakes work, and the lights work, and physically the vehicles are safe, although there are only 13 inspectors for 12,000 vehicles. So that's kind of a stretch for those folks. But what Captain Urquhart really was kind of pushing was that we need to follow up more on the human side of the student transportation, and that's looking at who these drivers are, looking maybe at criminal backgrounds, checking their records and their driving records, which their driving records are evaluated, but I think in a lot of cases, for instance, this incident with Amanda, the driver of that vehicle had marijuana in his system. And I think if a criminal background check might have been done in that case, they might have found out that there was some problems with that driver. So I'm kind of working with Senator Hand on this, looking at a two-prong approach where number one is some tightening up the restrictions on these Type 3 vehicles. Captain Urquhart, the most surprising thing I've learned is that, you know, you can't have alcohol in your system operating a school bus. Unless it's a Type 3 vehicle, then you can have up to the legal limit of alcohol in your system. So there's some obvious red flags that I think need to be addressed. And the other part of the legislation, which is probably going to be more difficult to follow up on, is working with the State Patrol and the Department of Public Safety to look at inspectors or staff that can examine drivers' records, and not just their driving records, but if they have a criminal record. And so that there's a real cost to that. And there's also a cost to some of these other proposals, but I think of a lot of it could be wrapped into, maybe the contractors or the school districts, which I don't think they want to hear too much about that. But it's really more housekeeping things like, doing follow-ups on drug and alcohol testing and those kinds of things. But so there's about three or four issues that I want to pursue under the Type 3 vehicles, and that's right now you can have a D license to operate them, and I'm looking at some other classification of license, and then also some sort of an endorsement. You know, maybe not the full endorsement that bus drivers have to operate a regular-sized school bus, but something more, something that would require some training and working with students and operation of the vehicles and those kinds of things. And Captain Urquhart's been very gracious in not telling me what legislation to write, but giving me guidelines into already existing law that we can adapt to these Type 3 vehicles. And then also probably looking at drug and alcohol testing at pre-employment and random testing. And so those are three areas within the Type 3s that I think if we tighten those up, we'll see a lot more, a safer ride for our kids to and from school. So I'm meeting with Captain Donansky or Colonel Donansky of the State Patrol tomorrow, and I'm also going to be meeting with the School Boards Association. They have some concerns with the Type 3, where that might go. And then, interestingly enough, the attorneys of Amanda, her parents' attorneys, and the attorney from the bus company, we're going to meet and try to talk of some recommendations that they have that they feel might, you know, help our students be safer on their rides home. And then this is kind of an ancillary note, but met with the Waite House staff. And the Waite House is the kids that were on the bus that when the I-35W bridge fell. And, you know, we have these debates about seat belts and all these kinds of things. And when you see, when we were down there for transportation and saw how far that bus fell when that bridge went down and how the kids really got out of there, I guess we thought, without any injury. But come to find that a lot of those kids are having, you know, some pretty serious emotional problems. And also they're having some physical problems. A lot of them are in physical therapy and seeing chiropractors. And I guess as a transportation member, I feel kind of bad because I didn't realize this was happening. It kind of slid under the radar. We thought the kids were all okay. So I'm meeting with them again tomorrow with the governor, somebody from the governor's office, to make sure that they get all the adequate health care that they need, because we've been told some of them need MRIs and they haven't gotten them. So we're going to work on that front. And the only reason I really bring that up is when we talk about the debate about seat belts, you know, they didn't have seat belts, but the question is, because of where that bus landed, they were okay. But if that bus would have landed further back and they would have been in the water and they had seat belts on, what would have been the outcome? Or if it would have been further ahead where the truck was on fire and they had seat belts on, would they have been able to get out? So that just adds more to the debate on seat belts. And then the final thing I'd like to say is that although we're discussing this in transportation, it's real, or in education, it really will travel through transportation. So once the bill that I hope to be working on here is drafted, you guys will all get a copy of it, but it will really travel through transportation. And so it's kind of a hybrid there, but I feel that this has been very valuable. I think we found a real kind of a donut hole here that has been a slip up in our system, because I think our transportation system for the kids is very safe, but I think that these type 3s are something that we really need to address. And then also the human factor on who's driving the buses, I think we need to look at that more too. And Senator Hand, do you have anything?
Yes, Senator Hand. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Olsen has done a great job of summarizing what we've talked about, and I think he's right. The testimony we got, which was very good, I think one of the points that we should emphasize for the public is that our student transportation system is, on the whole, very, very safe. It is much more safe than the normal expectations we get just from driving around. In fact, I think at one point they said that there probably are more injuries occurring from high school students driving their own cars to school than what you experience in bus transportation. All that being said, as Senator Olsen has indicated, we have had some very tragic events involving bus transportation, and it seems as if most of those instances do center around driver qualification or lapses in judgment or training or whatever it might be. And I think that in terms of focus, I think the committee is in agreement that we should take some effort to make sure that the qualifications that we expect of all drivers, of all public or all student transportation, are well qualified and have the procedures in place to assure that. As Senator Olsen has mentioned, there is some concern about the kind of licensing qualification for type 3. School districts, I know, use teachers and other staff sometimes to drive students places, and so the kind of requirements we put in place, we want to be careful that we're not putting impediments in the ability of schools to do the kinds of things they need to do to facilitate their programming. But there is an opportunity, I think, for us to come up with some recommendations, and Senator Olsen has been great about leading this, and I think we're going to have some, we hope, improvements in qualifications for all drivers and making sure that that's more uniformly applied to everybody who's transporting kids.
Thank you. Questions? You're meeting with various parties, obviously, ongoing. You anticipate to have a draft ready at the start of session?
Yes.
Very good. Thank you for that update. Senators Rummel and Lynch, Senator Rummel, on expectations and accountability, and we had a very good briefing on the earlier meetings that you had, and I know you have one coming up as well, so give us the update.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, we have We haven't got a whole lot new information to give you today, so I'm not going to go over everything we went over at the last hearing. Just to recap, we set out to have a joint House and Senate committee that would work on our expectations and accountability system here in the state. The goal was to set up a system that is both stable and meaningful, and we had a three-part dialogue. The first part was a conversation that included well over an hour with the department that reviewed, the department reviewed for us the report card, its components, their expectations for the report card. They too want it to be meaningful and user-friendly. They want it to also reflect the requirements of the various laws under which we operate, and they are working on a value-added component to the report card. At that first meeting, superintendents reported on the impact of the report card as it currently stands. There is strong agreement that we want a growth factor on the report card. There were a range of other suggestions, everything from physical education to world languages. In other words, the kind of course taking that we have at our schools and class sizes. Most of the superintendents reported that it was a good thing to drop the star rating because they felt it oversimplified the work that's being done in schools. One superintendent spoke specifically about ranking without context. It's very difficult for the public to make sense out of ranking if they don't have the context. And if the point of the report card is to serve the public, that seems to be an important component. Our second hearing, and I continue to want to apologize for it. It was a 4.5-hour hearing. We heard from a wide range of folks that spoke to three different areas of the report card or the education of our students. The expectations seemed to cluster around kids being ready to start school, so that school preparedness. There is a number of people testifying what we need to do in order to know that we have children who are ready to start school. The second group of testifiers spoke to us about the end in view. And one of the most dominant themes we heard was that we want our children in today's set of expectations to be ready for at least not only to attend 2 years of college or post-secondary school, but to complete it successfully. And there are a number of expectations along that line. And then finally, multiple perspectives on a variety of things from special education to testing and measurement, teachers in the community. Based on that testimony, we worked with the University of Minnesota, who are very generous on a number of the experts who have been working on accountability issues for years, helped us sort out the data that we heard. And they gave us an excellent presentation in December, I believe it was. The first thing they helped us clarify is that accountability is not for its own sake. Accountability is about furthering the goals of education. And that means the excellence of our education, the equity, the preparation for higher education, and then the balance between more preparation and core academic classes. So first we had to look at the goals of education. Secondly, they made suggestions about the criteria that we should use as we think about what we might do to change the report card. First and foremost, again, do the changes serve the audience for which the report card is intended? Do the changes foster the goals of education? Do the changes produce measures that impact educational improvement, and then finally feasibility and cost. So a lot of those filters will be used as we actually work toward making our recommendations. Since that third hearing, we've created three small groups, and I think I have a list of who they are. I think I brought that. One group is working on the growth model. They're being led by Jeff I'm not going to pronounce his name right, Mariyama, and Ginny Karbowski and Greg Schoenecker. And I think Dr. Opatz is also part of that group. And they will be working on the growth model component. The rigorous coursework was led by Dr. David Heisted. Participating with him would be Tom Watkins and Jim Angermeyer, and they will be working on if coursework is one of the predictors of success after high school, then how will we report that? And then finally, there was a group led by Dr. Norlin Weaver, working with Dr. Sandy Christensen and Dr. Michael Resnick, working on climate safety and student engagement. And we should be working in an informal session this Friday to hear what those subgroups, what sense they have made out of all the data we had. And then from that subgroup, we will be probably framing up some legislation that we will bring before this committee in the next session.
Good. Senator Lynch?
Questions? And Senator Rummel, thank you for, and members for your work on this. Is there anything you might be able to forecast yet as to changes in the report card?
I am going to echo what Senator Dubanoff said. The reason we bring folks to help us make these decisions together is to learn from their advice. So I'm going to hold off on that until I hear from them on Friday.
Okay.
But I think it will cover those three areas, the rigorous coursework. We're not going to, and let's not drop that we will have the testing data. All the things required by law will remain. So it isn't like those things, but we will be looking possibly at how we can deal with rigorous coursework, how we can deal with the growth model, and what, if anything, we can do about student engagement and school climate. So
Okay. That's
what it will look like.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just add to that with regard to the report card. I think that's been one of the perhaps one of the most exciting developments that we'll see come out of this work group. And I think that there was a desire going into this to have a discussion about what is it that we can do to make sure that this report card is truly a tool for parents and is a true reflection of what's happening in the education community across Minnesota. And so it's my hope that that it will be an enhanced tool and become more meaningful and capture some of those things that we have identified as areas that maybe are deficient or maybe areas that we would like to have a little stronger focus on. So you can look forward to some good things coming out of that.
Good. Senator Rummel.
And the thing that excites me most about it is it will, I think, help us see how our early childhood education, our K-12 education, aligns with our higher education so that there is a better meshing of all of those things. I've had, since the last meeting, school board members from Matamidi come to me and ask me about using the AccuPlacer. That's a test that our community colleges use to place students. And they're saying, well, why shouldn't we or couldn't we use the AccuPlacer in high school and know ahead of time whether students are ready for that community college involvement? So I thought that was a very good question. These are some of the things that we want to struggle with. We may not get to all of the overlap in our testing systems, but certainly if we can get this alignment so that from before children enter kindergarten to the time that children are entering post-secondary education, that everything we are doing aligns and we are not wasting both taxpayers' money and the energy and time of our professionals.
Good. Thank you. Senator Torres-Ray, Achievement Gap.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We have really used this time to connect with some members of the community, particularly superintendents. As you probably recall, we did a report during our last committee meeting and announced that we were possibly pursuing the idea of proposing legislation to ask the different districts to come up with a plan. And I am very pleased with the reviews and the feedback that I have received. We have received a number of calls in the office, particularly from teachers and superintendents who are already working on this issue. And they feel very strongly that this could be a very good approach because they are already working on it. And they thought that this was really a positive direction because many of the districts that are struggling with this issue, with achievement gap right now, are preparing to deal with it. And what they hope will happen with this proposal, if we move forward with it, is that it will create some consistency in the approach so that we could, as a state, have a plan in place that people could review and use. So they really applaud our effort to bring people together and consult directly with them, number one, and two, adding the consistency. They also are hoping that we will provide some space to look at what is happening nationally, because many of them know that other states are also working on it and are making progress, but they independently will have a hard time getting this information. And because we had already contacted the staff from the National Council on State Legislators, they are working with us on doing that research right now to bring us that information and let us provide a report to Minnesota about models that are being implemented throughout the nation. So we will be sharing that with independent districts to let them know that, that those are models that are being applied in other parts of the country. We are planning to another point that superintendent from Rochester brought to our attention was that we need to really think very carefully about an evaluation component, that will be very helpful, because we need to figure out, as we build consistency and create some benchmarks and measure progress, we need to add evaluation. And some people are also talking about some of the comments that were made by the by members of this committee with respect to the incentives that need to be provided and the resources. So we're talking about, you know, what can be done this year in terms of policy only, and then preparing for next year to add resources to that so that we can do it in incremental steps. My office is now preparing a meeting with superintendents from schools that have the greatest and highest concentration of children of color in their districts right now. I have a doctoral student that was offered to us by the University of Minnesota. Actually, I have two who are working with the Department of Education to put together a report to really come up with a specific list of the different districts. And we're consulting with Dr. Myers as to how do we really review those numbers to make sure that we not only look at highest concentration, but we also look at those that are struggling right now with gaps, and how do we define that. And so the university has been really helpful to us, and we're really consulting with people who have a lot of expertise in this area to put together this meeting and have a good conversation with the superintendents. So right now we're busy doing that, and as soon as we have a better idea of how we put this together and how you know, the reactions of the superintendents could be collected. There is one more thing that we're doing with the commissioner and other members of the communities, that we're putting together a list of models that have been identified by the Department of Education and other different groups as models that we should review because they are making progress. So those two things are right now our priorities, and as we compile that information, we will bring that to the committee so that you will know what we're doing. So we're doing the national, compiling the information about policies that have been proposed at the national level. We're meeting with the different superintendents where we have high concentration of children of color and some large gaps, and also looking at models that are that are working in the state of Minnesota with the commissioner that you need to know about. So those are the three things we're doing.
Okay, very good. Questions? Okay, and your next meeting will be when?
We're trying to figure out because we want to meet with Superintendent and Mr. Chair, so we really don't have a clear sense. We want to make sure that when we come back to the next meeting, we bring a couple of representatives from the superintendent so that they can report on that meeting and want to be ready with the information that is being compiled by the university students. So the final meeting will have all of that information, and we need to finish it up.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Early intervention and literacy, Senators Seltzman and Olson.
Well, perhaps, Mr. Chair, I'll start out. But, you know, as we've been hearing about early childhood and the achievement gap, Senator Olson and I are very excited because of a lot of what we've been hearing about really addresses many of the issues of how we identify children who have, you know, learning needs earlier and also how that affects the achievement gap. So we're very excited with what we've been hearing. Our last hearing was in December, and it was 3 hours of extremely powerful testimony from parents about the struggles that they have witnessed their children going through when they have struggled to read. And it was just incredible testimony because these parents repeatedly talked about these special efforts that they made, many of whom had very wonderful jobs as executives, and decided that our children are not able to read, and went on a mission to try to find programs and tutored. And this was not, though, an issue where they were pointing fingers at teachers or schools, but talking about, you know, that it's just very difficult to find all these best practices. And now that their children, some of whom are in college, what was most impressive is that they came to the table and said, I don't want other children to have to go through what my children went through. Or our family had the means to do this. And we understand that there are thousands of children out there who don't have parents who can quit their job, who can find private tutoring. And so they are moms on a mission. And they really want to see what we can do to make sure that best practices in terms of reading are within in our public schools. So that was sort of the challenge. But then the piece that to us is so positive is that we also felt we heard the solution. And that's that we have reading practices that are extremely effective, but what's happening is that our teachers don't always understand them, and that we heard repeatedly from teachers that they need to be retrained. And we've also heard from younger teachers who are in their first years of teaching that as they've come out of their teacher colleges and they're interviewed for their jobs in schools that are trying to incorporate these specific strategies, during, you know, an interview and a principal talks to them, one teacher said, I had no idea what this principal was talking about. I had no idea about the strategies that they were referring to. So the Board of Teaching right now is working on developing reading standards, and it's an interesting discussion in that It's difficult to have reform, but I think that we're having a very good discussion. So our next hearing is really going to focus on staff development issues and to have an update from our Board of Teaching and to hear sort of what is their role, what should we be doing with the reading standards, because everyone has agreed they're not where they should be, but to start to talk about where they're at in their process. We'll also be hearing from some of the programs across the state where they are training teachers, where they are, what is involved in these kind of programs to get staff up to speed. The young teacher who spoke about to us that she didn't really understand what these strategies were, we asked her, so, you know, you're doing it now. What happened? You know, how did you get trained? And she said, well, before I started teaching, my school district sent me to a 3-day workshop. And there was sort of this thought of, and why couldn't we cover this in 4 years of college? And we'd sort of like to ask that question. And certainly this teacher is not a reading tutor or a master teacher, but at least we need to make sure that our teachers have a good understanding. And all of this is also linked with the RTI in that, you know, the reading strategies are very important. We have some of this in statute now, but the issue is we really mean it. So I want to ask Senator Olson to also, because it has been such a pleasure to work with her. The other thing that happened as a result of this hearing in December is that one of the parents wanted to put together a video, sort of the best of the testimony, and she is in the process of doing that because it was 3 hours of testimony. And, you know, to ask you to watch 3 hours of testimony is a lot, but if we could give you the best of that, because we believe this is something extremely important that we absolutely could have an impact on. So,
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and Senator Saltzman has given a good review of what we have been up to since our last meeting. And it has been a real pleasure to work with her, and I think we share the same kind of passion. And I was reflecting as I was listening to some of the other reports, we were talking about readiness as being so important. Well, the root word in readiness is read. And reading is at the very core of what needs to be done. And we know we have the techniques, the research-based methods, and yet we don't have them in practice yet. And that is what we've been learning in the testimony along the way. I would reiterate the comments that Senator Saltzman made about our last hearing. When it was over, I turned to Ed Cook, who's sitting right behind me here, our researcher for our caucus in education, and he said to me, "I've worked for the Senate since 1993, and I've never attended a better hearing." Is that a correct assessment of what? And that to me was powerful. It was a 3-hour hearing. It was recorded by our Senate media, and so you can go into the archives and listen to the entire 3 hours. But as Senator Saltzman has said, one of the moms who is proficient in this area had volunteered to try to condense that down. We think it's probably getting close to ready, but just to how short. But take out the gap time, and if there's some things that were somewhat duplicative, that to eliminate that, to make it easier. And it will be on DVD. It may also be put back online that can be linked to it. We will communicate that. But we do believe that more people, not only our colleagues, but the outside of it, need to hear what we were hearing, because there was power in those words of people who have been through there, that have walked this walk, who can testify to the effectiveness of some of the things that we believe need to be done. And it is true, we've been monitoring the task force work for the Board of Teaching, and have recognized that there is a missing link here in terms of the belief that you can in fact prepare teachers to teach, not just to know about particularly the phonemic awareness, the structure of the language. That's true for people who are first learning our language. It is true for virtually everyone who is going to be a reader. Some can pick this up naturally by other means. But without some of the strategies that we now know will help people become good readers, that we have dismissed as probably never achieving that, has kind of fueled our fire, that we need to be sure that our teachers are having the opportunity to experience that success by being well prepared. And that process is going on right now in terms of the standards, and which will translate into the expectations of our teacher preparation programs. But how that will, I will confess that we are hearing a little bit of pushback on this. So we haven't formulated any recommendations, but if we do have some, they may be in that realm of being assured that our teachers are getting this opportunity to prepare, and then perhaps for some incentives for those teachers who are there. And when I say teachers, I'm talking about all elementary ed teachers, particularly our K-3 or E-3, need it. All of them need it, not just special ed. Some would like to compartmentalize this into special ed. It should not be. And the response to intervention, the RTI, things that we've put in place, those are techniques and processes that in terms of how, as you apply some of these strategies, how you measure and determine what's working for for a number of children or an individual child, so that you then can change and respond and help them grow. Those techniques need to be learned as teachers are preparing. And they are pre-special ed. So we need to be having some solid teacher education changes to address these areas, and that whether it will translate into a need for some tinkering with our legislation to assure that that happens, we will hold out until we get the results of our next hearing and perhaps some follow-up work on putting together those recommendations, as others have said.
Very good. Add something else?
Yes. Senator Lynch has a question.
Yes.
A couple comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to thank Senator Saltzman and Senator Olson for their work in this area. I think that this is an area of the magnitude. We heard earlier from Senator Bonoff on early childhood. This is a critical component, and this is an area that we really could make a difference in.
Yep.
And I would suggest to members of the committee that if our students in our Minnesota schools are able to read at grade level in those early years, at the end of the second grade, the end of third grade, lots of the other things that are weighing down our public education system are going to evaporate and go by the wayside. This is just a critical piece. I want to reemphasize the fact one of you say that all of our teachers need this. We heard just yesterday in Senator Wiergin's district, a teacher spoke to us during that testimony and sort of gave us the rundown of his class, is some 36 students. And he said, you know, I have six that are very low-achieving students. And he told us about a student, I think it was in the fourth grade, and this particular student came to his class, didn't even know the 12 months of the year. On the other end of the spectrum, he said, I have six students in my class that are reading at college level. And his question was, well, what do I do? So it is really every single teacher. It's not the reading teacher. It's not the specialist. It's not special ed. It's every single teacher. And I have heard from constituents in my district on this issue, particularly with regard to the work of the task force with the Board of Teaching in this area. And I, too, have heard and experienced some of that, frankly, pushback. And I encourage you to keep up the good fight.
You will.
Because it's just too important.
Senator Saltzman.
So to that point, Mr. Chair, we will be very interested in seeking the support of members who are on higher ed. Because, again, this is not pointing fingers at all, but it is very important. And just three very quick things. One of the things that was powerful was the parent who said when she drove her child for the first time to work with some of the tutors who were available, that her daughter had memorized the word one, O-N-E, because there's no rules to that. And she said, we were driving home, and she said, we turned off on Penn Avenue, and all of a sudden, her daughter went, one, W-A. And she said this was a breakthrough that she could read. And so we heard from parents that they saw their children progress as they were driving home from the tutor and could start reading traffic signs, which was, you know, I mean, it was simple things that were a third and fourth grader. And the other thing was the parents who talked about how they lost their children when they couldn't read, that when their third grade son came home and crawled under the table in a fetal position because all day long he had felt stupid, was so heart-wrenching. And to hear that, and then to hear, I got my child back when they learned to read, that was powerful, and the impact on mental health. One last thing is, I know I sent to a number of you an article from Dr. Stuart Yeh at the U of M. It was just published in December. And he talks about the most effective strategies for closing the achievement gap. And the first one was talking about this progressive monitoring where you are evaluating students, and really that is driving the instruction. And one last thing to Senator, and then I promise to be done, is that Senator Lynch, is that the Reading Center in Rochester has been very helpful, and they are a model. And one of the things we're hearing is that they have staff who have been working with Winona State and offering some of these programs within higher ed. We're hearing that there are some new professors there who think they don't need to do that anymore. So they may be getting a call from us as well.
You definitely have their attention. No, so thank you for the progress report. We'll go next to the Technology and Learning, Senator Carlson and Jungbauer. And we'll probably go to the third item on the agenda at about 25 to 10, if you're wondering. I don't know if any House members have arrived yet, and I would like to spend a few minutes on legislative proposals, some that we've read about, and just put a few things on the table as well. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and ours will be short because there isn't a lot to report. We did not manage to get to some of the places that we wanted to go to, but we did have four areas of concern. First was the technology in use by schools to record and exchange information between districts. That was brought up by a visit to TIES, which a lot of the technology people were there from several school districts, and they said that that's a major problem for them, and that we still need to do some work on trying to figure out how school districts can talk to each other to keep the information up to date. Keep the information following the students and up to date. Second was the technology in use by students. And there we were able to go to a Stillwater School District elementary school where they give everyone a laptop in that school. And I think that was one of the most interesting and engaging visits that we had, where the students were working in their classrooms. There were major advantages in all areas, even in discipline, because the teacher could turn away, come and speak to us, and the students were still progressing in the class. And it's the kinds of things that kids can learn at home, and parents can learn at home also. That was a very eye-opening experience when the principal talked about one parent asking if they could use that computer to get a job. And so here, the whole family is learning from the laptop program. The third area was the technology to communicate and teach within the classroom. And that includes assessment also, and that's going to be a bigger problem in the future than it is today, perhaps. excuse me. And that's an area where we did not manage to get to a visit, which I'd still like to do, and that's to my own school district that has a tremendous amount of technology in use in the classroom for interactive learning, and it's including wireless systems, projection systems. They have used smart boards in the past. There's even one system that I want to make special mention of, and that's for a disabled student who has a problem hearing. And they use wireless broadcast within the classroom where the student will wear a hearing aid that is connected to the wireless system. There's also things like the arts and interactive learning and distance learning, too. The fourth area of interest is the technology in use to communicate to parents. And what this is the systems of using websites to put the syllabus up, to put grades up, to communicate back and forth to parents. And, of course, that includes email and voicemail. And in particular, my school district, the voicemail actually is in connection with the email. You find out that you have a voicemail because it comes up on the teacher's email. So things can be addressed during breaks in the class. They can go right to the telephone and respond to a telephone call. There's a lot of technologies like that that are in use. And the unfortunate part about it is that they all cost money. And I think probably the most disturbing response I got from anywhere was that we can't pass a levy for technology. And Senator Jungbauer and I were just talking about it now that, here's what we can do. Now we have to have the money to do it. And I know in my own district, and I think we We would experience that in the Stillwater District, where there's a lot of what you would probably call as higher-level income earners in the area, and they earn it from technology. For instance, the 3M people that live in the Stillwater area, they recognize that technology in the classroom is what you need, and so their tendency is to support those kinds of funds. In my particular area, in District 196 in Rosemont, Apple Valley, Eagan, the same thing happens. We passed a $55 million technology levy only 2 years ago. And those are the kinds of things that I think it behooves us to be able to communicate to the rest of ourselves and of the state that we need to invest in those technologies.
Thank you. Senator Jungbauer?
I would just like to follow up, and I think we've seen a good example last night at Edgewood that it's my opinion, and after some of these site visits to different things around the state, is I think part of our problem is we're selling what education brings to kids today the wrong way. I mean, people are constantly bombarded with, we need more money, we need more money, we need more money, but we need to have the schools open up to the community and say, for instance, if we're trying to have a levy for technology, bring the community in and show them what the technology is we're going to use and how it engages the kids, and then it's a whole different story. We have the ability to make that decision as citizens, and when we go out to vote, based on what we see, what we can actually see the application of, because a lot of people that I'm talking to, they have no idea until they get their cell phone and they have to get their 11 or 12-year-old to show them how to use it. And then they understand kids get it. So I was really impressed at Edgewood last night because they didn't say we need more money. They said, here's what our kids are engaged with. Here's the kind of technology we're using. Here's what goes on out there in the real world. And we're training kids for things, technology we don't know in the future. These kids will be inventing it. We're giving them skills to solve problems that don't exist today. And technology is trying to train them to understand technologies that, again, they're going to be the ones introducing. They're going to be the ones inventing it, because technology is going so rapidly that I think the whole issue has to be framed in a different way so that people can make an informed decision based on how the kids utilize it, because it's something that, quite honestly, I can't use technology the way my kids can, and they do need that education, and they need their hands on the latest technology. Senator Carlson and I were saying that instead of people saying we should give our used computers to the schools, it's more like the schools should have the new computers. They should hand them down to us, because we're not smart enough to use the latest and greatest technology. Our kids are.
Thank you for that update. Questions? Okay. We'll open it up now for any proposals, ideas that you'd just like to put on the table. Share, and can go in any particular order. I have a couple things that are there that I can make a passing reference to last, but is there anyone that would like to? Yes, Senator Torres Ray.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I am exploring an idea that was brought to my attention by McKnight Foundation and some child care providers. I don't know if it is going to come to this committee, but just want to briefly let you know that there is a gap, apparently, in subsidy for early childhood child care type of service for low-income working families that change place of residency or jobs. It was brought to my attention, and they said that it may come to this committee as well, but I'm thinking that it only will go to the Human Services Committee.
Probably, yeah.
Because the families, as I understand it, is it's an issue that is tied to the child care subsidy. And families that change jobs, or families that do not, or families that change place of residency, when they do that, there is a gap in payments, and the families do not receive that for 3 to 4 weeks until the department is able to do the paperwork. And this is a tremendous burden for low-income families. But I'm not sure yet. But if it does, I just want to let you know that I'll bring it to your attention.
Okay.
Because it applies also the subsidy for the payments that early childhood child care centers receive. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how that will connect here.
It is germane. So. Okay. Thank you, Senator Torres-Wright. Any other items that members would like to give a heads up on that they're working on that would likely come before the committee? Okay. I do have one item that I've mentioned in the past, and it's a proposal for early childhood, the K-12, and higher learning working together in a P-20 council. And you know, we have right now the P-16 council, which the legislature is not a part of. And actually, we're one of the few states that doesn't have the legislature involved in such type of planning. We've talked several times in your updates about the importance of the systems working together, and so that would be the intent of the draft, and I have that for you. Senator Torres Ray and others, you've mentioned organizations like National Conference of State Legislatures. I did get quite a bit of feedback from the Education Commission of States, which is putting a big focus on this area. And I was appointed to be our representative to ECS, and so taking that seriously, I have looked at a lot of their efforts and did get some of their feedback as well on the draft. So if there's suggestions that you have on the draft, or if anyone in the audience would like a copy, I believe there's one there, or you can get it from our office. I do have a couple of working drafts as well regarding the permanent school fund, and it's just for discussion, but we'll wait to get further discussion from participants that we'll be hearing from soon. Is there any other item that you'd like to share as we prepare for session and look at a fairly fast-paced few weeks as we look at the recommendations, if any, that you have from your respective subcommittees and any other unfinished business from last session? Senator Saltzman.
Yes. All the trips that we've gone on have been so helpful, Mr. Chair, and I think that one of the things, and I see this on our agenda for AP classes, was some of the testimony that we heard in southern Minnesota regarding students who are taking PSEO classes that oftentimes are not as rigorous as those in our public schools, and particularly from some of the from a particular school that had done an audit of, you know, students were going to take PSEO but were taking stress management and yoga, and I don't know that that was our intent, that they should be taking higher level math courses or some of those things. So I think that that's a good discussion, that I hope then that will you be including that within this discussion of AP?
Yes, we will have PSEO for the February 4th. If I could call your attention to the calendar for February 4th, advanced placement, but we'll talk about PSEO. I assume concurrent enrollment, any post-secondary option programs would be the intent to talk about.
Good. Thank you.
And looking at the calendar, if there's any additional items that you want to, you know, call to our attention, make sure we do that. You can see we will be meeting February 13 again at the Science Museum to talk about the SciMath Minnesota and initiatives, the progress, the update, and I thought that was helpful. It's my hope, too, that we can do this jointly with the House, and I have asked that they please join us in doing that. Senator Rummel has put a lot of suggestions together on testing programs, and we have a hearing that's being put together on that as well.
January 25th.
And there'll be more information that you'll get. We also have a meeting the same day with the Higher Ed Committee, and that's provided for your information. A lot of the discussion there will be on advanced placement as well, but we have the the national leader for the organization, Senator Pappas, was in New York recently and met with some of their leaders, and we're going to talk about it. And And hopefully we'll have some background. There was a story about an audit, some AP information, and different policy questions. And so we'll go into the meeting with some awareness as well. And the other items were just plugging in the various committee meeting dates, but it'll be focusing again on the subcommittee work that's been done, plus any other initiatives that you'd like to advance. Yes, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Senator Wicker. I just wanted to thank you for giving us some heads up and some advance warning. Sometimes we just get notice of committees the day before, and it makes it very hard to manage calendars, and I think this is very useful, and I just want to let you know I appreciate it.
Well, let me thank staff for, you know, putting it together, and again, we all appreciate getting the early notice. We now are waiting for the House members to arrive, which I believe will be very soon, so I don't want to start the presentation on the permanent school fund without their presence, but I believe they should be here any moment. What I would ask is for the presenters, if they could be at the table, and perhaps if Gray Schwab could also join them, and we'll be looking at maybe a 10-minute overview on the fund. Most of us that went on that trip have already been given that background and have had a chance for Q&A, but this will be for the benefit of everyone, plus any updated information. Then we'll ask Grace Schwab to talk about what the School Boards Association recently recommended at their delegate assembly, and then open it up just for any discussion that we might have. Any further questions on the calendar or upcoming session at this point? Okay, we'll recess until the House gets here, which will hopefully be very soon.
I hope so.
Zan Dietrich from the House, and will you have some members joining us?
Hopefully so, but we have 10 o'clock on our schedule, so I'm not sure. But okay. That's okay. I think we should proceed, and if they join us, that's good.
Okay, we apologize for the schedule mix-up, but because of the schedule that Senate members were told and some other commitments, we do need to proceed. So thanks for understanding. But Representative Dietrich, would you like to mention the House's leadership role in this issue, just for the audience and Senator's background?
Yes, good morning.
She needs a mic.
Thank you, Senator Wicker, for holding this joint meeting. The House Education Committee, Finance Education Committee, has had this working group of school trust lands since we, very shortly after we adjourned last year. And then it was, thank you to Senator Wicker, it was his vision to have us all go up north and look actually at the school trust lands and have the DNR take us on a tour. And we got firsthand, hands-on walking experience as to what these lands look like, what are they doing, and we had just a great discussion. And so we thought it would be a wise use of both bodies' time if we could collaborate on some of these issues and have some joint hearings. So Senator Wicker was kind enough to invite us here today. We do have three other members on this committee, and they are unfortunate. Two of them, for sure, I know are not able to come, and I was hoping Representative Brown would be here, but I'm not totally sure. So I'm a lot of unknowns, aren't I? So hopefully one of them will still be in attendance here yet this morning.
But you're
going to
write
see.
The legislation?
Yes.
Okay. Well, members, if we can proceed, we're going to get about a 10-minute overview, some discussion, and then open it up to some concepts.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. I'm Marty Vadas, and I'm the director of the DNR Lands and Minerals Division, and very appreciative of the opportunity to come today and talk about school trust land and management of that land. Kathy Lewis and I have this overview presentation, and it is very similar. It's updated from the one that we used on the field trip that was referred to this summer, and I know many of the members here were able to attend that tour. And this overview really looks at what are school trust lands and how do they come into state ownership, the land ownership and management unit type information, what a trust is and trustees' duties and responsibilities, and finally we want to talk about the revenue that's been generated from these lands. So with that, we'll go ahead and get started. And also in attendance today is Director Dave Epperly from the Division of Forestry of DNR. And we're able to answer questions if you have some.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. I'm Kathy Lewis, Assistant Director with the Lands and Minerals Division. I'm first going to start off with a little bit of history for you. What we're talking about today are the school trust lands. And the school trust lands are actually made up of three federal land grants. And we do have, I also would like to say, we do have this in a handout for the presentation. And in the pack, the little booklet that you got on our report, this map is actually on page 6 of the report. So these two items behind me in front of you. School trust lands are defined in Minnesota Statutes 92.025 as lands granted for use of schools, swamp lands granted to the state, and internal improvement lands. In the Constitution, they're called permanent school fund lands, so you'll see both terms used. The proceeds of these three different land grants have been combined by the Constitution into the permanent school fund. The first grant land grant we want to talk about is the school and indemnity school lands. If you remember back in the early days of this territory, back in 1849, when Minnesota was authorized to be a territory, sections 16 and 36 were reserved for purposes of being applied to the schools in the territory. Then the Enabling Act of 1857, where U.S. Congress authorized the state to form a constitution and a state government, sections 16 and 36 of every township were granted for the use of schools. When the state was admitted to the Union, the grant was actually conveyed. Now, some people say, oh, school lands, they think, oh, you put a schoolhouse there. No, the intent was always that the lands would be most likely sold and the revenue would be used for schools throughout the state. What happened is, of course, by the time the state became a union, some of the lands had already been preempted. People had settled on the lands and they had claims to it under federal law. Some of the land was still subject to Indians' rights of occupancy. There were also Indian reservations created. Some of the land in Section 16 and 36 was underwater. So what the Congress said is when that is the case, you can select alternative lands, and they're called indemnity school lands. They're in lieu of the Section 16 and 36. And they are. It actually took decades for the state to actually go through and select all of those indemnity school lands. Next federal land grant is called Swamp Grant, and in 1860, the U.S. Congress granted Minnesota 4.7 million acres of swamp and overflow waters. And we identified those lands through plat and field notes of government surveys. So that actually also took a period of time because quite a portion of the state was not surveyed until later in the 1800s. The Congress identified that the money from the sale of the lands was to be used to construct levees and drains. So the idea was that the lands would be sold, lands would be drained, they would become useful for agriculture, forestry, other uses, and then you would continue that practice. Well, the state didn't actually use the lands in that manner. About 3 million acres were given away by the state, and 2.8 million acres went to the railroads. They also, the state legislature at the time, also would make large grants of land for several public institutions. For example, Faribault Institute got 100,000 acres of land. The state prison got 100,000 acres of land. There was wagon roads and manufacturing associations. So the land was spread out and used. This was finally stopped in the late 1800s, and the remainder of the lands were directed to be used in the same manner as the school lands, and a permanent fund was created, and that permanent fund was eventually merged into the permanent school fund. And the last federal land grant is called Internal Improvement Lands. This was in 1866, and there were 500,000 acres granted to the state for use for roads and bridges and buildings. And it turned out that 99% of these lands were sold fairly quickly. Total revenue was about $3 million, and most of it went to pay off Minnesota State Railroad bonds that were issued to help finance early construction of railroads in Minnesota. Well, they finally said, okay, with the remainder of those lands, let's manage them more like school lands. They created a fund that split it into the proceeds into either the schools or the road and bridge fund, and eventually the remainder of the internal improvement lands and the funds were merged into the permanent school fund. Today, there are 2.5 million acres of school trust lands remaining. That's the combined land types. And there's an additional 1 million acres in mineral rights. When the lands were first sold by the state, mineral rights were conveyed with a surface interest. And then there was recognition in Wisconsin and Michigan and in upper Minnesota that we had some mineral potential there. And maybe the mineral rights should be reserved for the benefit of everybody in the state. So in 1889, the legislature authorized reservation of mineral rights where lands were sold in St. Louis, Lake, and Cook County. And in 1901, it became mandatory that mineral rights were reserved when the lands were sold for any lands acquired from an act of the U.S. Congress, except for lands granted to aid in the construction of the railroads. There's a little theme here that the railroads were very powerful in the early years of the statehood.
Current land ownership statistics. Next slide shows a graph that has the original acres that were granted to Minnesota by the federal government, and it's by the type of grant. So it's school, swamp, internal improvement. And the other column then shows the acres that are retained in 2007. And so as you can see, originally there were about 8 million acres that were granted, and today there's about 2.5 million acres of surface that remains in state ownership. And about 60% of those lands that are still in state ownership constitute wetlands, mostly from the original swamp land grant, and about 75% of them are 10 miles or more from any city or township with at least 5,000 people. And Minnesota is more like Western states, where Minnesota continues to own school trust lands. Most states did receive this type of grant. Iowa, for example, has zero school trust fund lands left. All of them have been sold. Wisconsin has about 5,000 acres from their original grant, and it was about equal in size to what Minnesota received originally. North Dakota has about 900,000 acres. And several of the western states have several million acres. So we're more like the western states. In the eastern U.S., really all those lands are essentially gone. So what remains today, then, state ownership is the 2.5 million acres of surface and 1 million acres of severed mineral rights. So minerals constitute about 3.5 million acres. And where these lands are located in Minnesota is the next graph, and there are 10 counties listed there, and those 10 counties have 90-plus percent of the school trust lands. And so the remaining 77 counties in Minnesota have really about 7.5%. So most of these lands are located in northern Minnesota. And a breakdown on the next slide of the management units that these lands are in, placed there by DNR. You'll notice that wildlife management areas are about 85,000 acres, and you should know in total there are 1,381 wildlife management acres and about 1.2 million acres in WMA status. And water access sites, there are about 2,800 acres, and that's on 120 sites. And you should know that there are about 1,585 water access sites. So this represents a percentage, but a fairly small percentage. And also, not listed on here, is there are currently about 86,000 acres of school trust land that are located in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area. And there are about 2,400 acres of permanent university trust fund land also located in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area. And on the next slide, there's been an effort in the past few years to exchange lands out of situations where they can't generate revenue for the school trust fund. And what we have on this slide is the recent work that's been done with state parks. A couple of years ago, there were about 4,900 acres of school trust land that were in state parks, and we were able to accomplish exchanging those out for lands outside of parks and in a situation where they're capable of generating revenue. And those parks were Teddy Gooch, Nurse Strand, Itasca, Savannah Portage, and Garden Island. And really today, then, what remains in park status is about 725 acres of school trust fund land, but they're located either in the Cuyuna Recreation Area or Hill Annex Mine State Park. And both of those situations allow revenue generation. As a matter of fact, there is a real estate lease for the trust land in Hill Annex State Park, and also there are 440s within that park that are under mineral lease to Minnesota Iron and Steel, which is a new steel facility that's being built on the range.
So now we're going to talk a little bit about law. The state has a trust. People throw around the word school trust lands, this is a trust, you're a trustee, what does that mean? In Black's Law Dictionary, trust means a right of property, real or personal, held by one party for the benefit of another. The key issue is that the person who is the trustee is held to be equitably deal with the property for the benefit of another person. Now, it's not the land grant alone that created the trust. It also happened through the acceptance of the grant by the state and the state's constitution's language that created the trust and established the beneficiary relationships. Courts have also looked at federal land grants that created specifically named beneficiaries, and they say when there's specifically named beneficiaries, there's a trust. And if you remember, the school trust grant said it's for the use of schools. Now, the swamp grant did not designate a beneficiary. So the swamp grant originally from the federal government was not creating a trust. It was subsequent actions in the Constitution and by the legislature that created, put the trust, swamp lands into the trust relationship. Now, this movement of school trust lands across the country that Marty mentioned is that in the western states, the U.S. Congress became very detailed and clear on how they would manage the school trust lands. And so they have, in the western states, have explicit language in their constitutions about trust duties. In Minnesota, there actually is no word in the Constitution that the school lands are trust lands. The word trust is used in land exchange statutes, but not in the school section. It's in the statutes that it's used. So we're a little bit different than the western states. Now, who is the trustee? The governor's a trustee. The legislature is a trustee. Commissioner of Natural Resources and the State Board of Investment have been delegated duties by the legislature to act as a trustee. So you're a trustee, we're a trustee. What should we be doing? There's some basic guidelines in trust law to help you. One of the questions you should ask is it within my authority to perform the act? Do I have a duty to act? If I must act, how shall I act? If I have a choice, does the act serve the interest of the trust? Constitution actually doesn't provide us a lot of direction. Talks about selling land at public auction, depositing revenue into the permanent school fund, distributing income to the school districts. The statutes provide more guidance. So, example, if somebody says, would you sell a piece of school trust land, we can say we only can sell it at public sale. We cannot get legislation to sell directly at private sale. It's in the Constitution. And there's provision in the statutes about the minimum price. Now, those haven't been amended for 40, 50 years, so we always sell way above minimum price. But they did set minimum prices in the statutes for the sale of school lands. Somebody may say, well, the exchange is parcel school land for another parcel. We're not required to do that, but we can do that. What we have to do when we do that is it in the benefit of the school trust to exchange these lands? So when we did the exchange out of the state parks, where the school trust lands were not generating revenue, we looked at lands where there was revenue possibilities. And so we exchanged them for lands that have timber revenue potential and gravel revenue potential. And that's what we looked at when we did the land exchange. Well, the body of trust law goes a little further, and it talks about some of the duties of a trust manager. And the courts hold the trust managers to a standard of skill of a person of ordinary prudence. However, if you have greater skill, such as if you're an attorney, if you're a geologist, if you're an engineer, you're held to a duty to exercise that skill. They also don't second-guess you in the trust law if you're judged on what was the prudent act at the time, not at some subsequent time when the conduct is called in question.
This is very informative, and as we noted earlier, we did have a visit with some orientation on the materials. If I could ask if you could maybe in the next 2 to 3 minutes get to the next 6 slides.
And sure, we'll do.
Okay,
so we'll talk a little bit more about the duties there. And we have duties to invest the assets, to lease, furnish information, be loyal to the beneficiary. And to finish up the trust portion, there is a legislative oversight committee that was established in the 1980s, and this is the Pima School Fund Advisory Committee, and they're established to advise the DNR on the management of the school trust lands and to review policies and statutes and management practices.
Revenue. So what has the state received from these lands? But let me go back just a second and talk about the exchanges. I mentioned the state parks. And you should know that we are also continuing on with doing an evaluation of other lands that are in a status where they can't generate revenue and coming up with a prioritized list for the next set of exchanges that we would like to do on those lands. And also perhaps some should be leased and some should be condemned. And that would be things like old growth or water access sites and that sort of thing. So we're continuing on with that. But the revenue, the goal of the Permanent School Fund is stated there, and that's out of Minnesota statute, and it's to secure the long-term economic return to the school trust. You can read it for yourself, along with that sound natural resource conservation management principles. So that's a direction in state statute for how these lands are to be managed. And the next graph shows over the last few fiscal years the gross and the net revenue from the school trust fund land. So, for example, in 2007, the gross revenue was $28 million and $16.6 was deposited into the school trust. And this shows the gross revenue from really the two major sources of income. One is from timber receipts, and the other was from leases, and principally those are mineral leases. So in fiscal 06, the gross was $24.7 million. In fiscal 07, it was $28 million. And should mention quickly the revenue to the corpus from the permanent for the permanent school fund and the mineral lease issue. And mineral leases, a portion is deposited into a mineral management account appropriated to DNR. It's also from land sales and forest campground fees, wild rice leases, and timber sales. And net revenue from the forestry suspense account. And right now, the Permanent School Fund has about $635 million in it. And the Permanent University Fund has about $407 million in it. And over the last few years, the return has been from the investment by the State Board of Investment has been about 4 to 6%. Next slide shows the net revenues from school trust fund land. So this is what was deposited into the permanent university fund in fiscal 06. It was $16.2 million. and fiscal 07 it was 16.6 million. Mineral revenue from school trust fund lands, that's just a graph that shows and it's growing. And just so you know, in fiscal 07, from all sources of land, the state collected about $28 million from mineral income. And in calendar year 2007, it was about the same, about $28 million. And we are on track to collect about $100 million over the next 4 years from mineral income.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Johnson.
Sorry to interrupt, Mr. Chairman, but to that point, what's the difference between the gross and net? $28 million is the gross, $16 is the net. What's the difference of $12 million?
The next slide, I think, will help explain that. But you should know from minerals, there are some potential increases in income. Minnesota Steel is a recently permitted mine up on the Iron Range. And there are about 2,000 acres of state-owned mineral rights that are under lease to Minnesota Steel, and that would represent an additional source of income. We also have lease requests from other taconite mines. And probably the biggest single potential future source of income is the acres of school mineral land that are under lease for copper, nickel, and platinum exploration in northern Minnesota. There are four companies that are actively exploring in northern Minnesota, and that represents tens, maybe even hundreds of millions of dollars of future income to the trust fund. And on the difference between the net and the gross, the next slide talks about the mineral management account. And how that is set up is 20% of the income generated from mineral leases goes into a mineral management account. And the legislature appropriates funding to DNR for management from that account. And I'll tell you, for all time, this activity has been supported by the general fund. And last biennium, this mineral management account was created. And it was set up so that it would fund the management activities, and there would be an additional $3 million that would go into that account. Or if there are low times in the income generation, that we could continue to have people available to work on the mineral issues for leasing for the future. That $3 million was quickly put into that account because of a lot of income that came in. And actually about 12% of the mineral income is what's going to support the activities that DNR does for the mineral management. And you also should know that in the current biennium that we're in now, it was proposed that the mineral management account would expire and that we would go back to general fund to support this activity. And that was in the governor's budget. And in the end, the mineral management account was made permanent. And it's what we're operating on now to manage minerals in the state.
Senator Johnson, a follow-up, and then Senator Olson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. $12 million of 28 is more than 20%. It's more like 40-plus.
Then there's the forestry receipts, and that's coming up as well.
Thank you.
You're right.
Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, sir, what percentage of the mineral management fund is coming from the 20% generated by the school trust plans?
The income to the mineral management account, Mr. Chair, Senator, is really from all sources of income. And so it would be a proportionate amount of what's generated by a school trust, by tax forfeit, by permanent university fund. So it would be about 12%.
12% of the overall fund.
Right.
Now, Mr. I have another question relative. Now, you're getting to forestry, but you've talked about water access. I don't think that's on here. There are a number, is that a regular boat water access? And you said there was about 1,200 of them that are on school trust lands?
Mr. Chair, there are about 1,200 total. There are about 120 that are on school trust lands.
120 that are?
Some of them are paying lease fees.
Are what?
Are paying a lease annual lease fee to the school trust fund. The Knife River Marina would be one example of that, where there are some where there is a rental payment that's being made to the trust to compensate the trust.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vattis, that some of those accesses are essentially privately managed rather than just open public accesses then? If there's paying a lease.
All public accesses, some of them, like the Knife River Marina, there is a private vendor that does operate the marina, but they're all open to the public.
So, Mr. Chair, then if they are providing some lease fees, why isn't the state that is using the trust lands paying some a fee for all of the ones that are public accesses?
Mr. Chair,
into that fund.
That is an excellent point. And I think I mentioned we're looking at those other situations, like where trust land was in state parks and there wasn't a potential to generate revenue. We are looking at those instances, this historic ones, where the land has been used for some purpose and there is no income being generated to the trust fund. We're looking at those now, identifying where they are. The idea of coming up with a prioritized list of either lease it or exchange it or do something so the trust is compensated.
So Mr. Chairman, how big, what percentage of the acreage that's in the current trust would you say are in that category that are not generating any revenue and that we would need to look at either exchanging or finding some way of generating some money?
A very small percentage.
Very small?
Very small. There's a chart, page 11. It does list the acreages, and it lists the percent of the school trust fund land that are in those management units.
Are you talking about page 11?
This
book?
This presentation.
The non-bond.
And exchanges.
What?
It's in the presentation. It's on page 11.
Mine doesn't look like yours.
I'm sorry, page 6. I have a different. It's the top. Chart on page 6.
There it is.
So, Mr. Chairman, that answers the percentage of trust land that's there. We still have a lot that are in state forests and campgrounds. Wildlife management areas, and I say all none of those. These are all lands that are not generating revenue at this point.
Mr. Chair, no. These are just the DNR management units, so state forests and campgrounds. So those are the.
I'm having a hard time hearing.
Those are the lands that generate the forestry income, and the same with wildlife management areas. Those lands are open for cutting of trees. And so this chart just shows what management units these lands are in. It doesn't necessarily mean they don't generate income. They do generate income.
Oh, okay. So Mr. Chair and Mr. Brett, what percentage of these lands, and maybe I miss it, are in some situation where they're not generating any revenue?
One example would be the lands in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area. Mm-hmm. Those do not generate any income. There may be some water access sites where there is not a lease payment that's made to the trust fund, and that's what we're working on figuring out now. There may be some scientific and natural areas where revenue generation cannot happen, and so that's what we're looking at the moment. It's a very small percentage of the total that would be in that category.
So, Mr. Chairman, there is an effort, however, whether it's organized or spread through units, to attempt to make recommendations for either exchange of some of those lands that aren't generating or to generate some revenue for the existing uses.
Mr. Chair, yes.
So, Mr. Chairman, then part of our role here is, since we're trustees too, is that we perhaps should be examining that more closely and nudging some of those processes along. If not pushing. Okay, thank you.
So moving on then.
We could get this summarized and then go to Ms. Schwab.
So we have the trust fund land sale revenues on the next slide. And this just shows there are some lands that are sold. Sale is not a first priority, but there are instances where land probably is best sold because it's not going to generate much revenue. Isolated 40s where we don't have access, can't get in there to cut the trees and so forth. So there are a limited number that are sold. And you'll notice in 2002 and 2005, it's a higher sale number, and that's because there were a couple of lakeshore lots that were sold in those years, and they generated really a fair amount of income from some small lots. Forestry management, and this would represent then the other deduction from what goes into the school permanent school trust fund, and how that works is revenue from timber sales and fees go into the forestry suspense account, and certain management costs are certified against those revenues. And the kind of allowed costs are for protection, improvement, administration, and management of forest roads. And there is a graph that shows what that history has been. And Dave Epperly can explain that perhaps better than I. But the net then is what's deposited into the permanent school trust fund. And so for forestry,
Sarah Hinn?
For example, for fiscal 06, the gross revenue from forestry was $11.3 million. And the amount that was deposited for that year into the school fund was $6.2
million. Mr. Chairman.
Sarah Hinn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Battis, for your presentation. I want to go back to your chart that's on our page 11 that shows the gross and net revenues from the school trust land. And I'm curious, in the last three fiscal periods, there's been about a 25% growth in the gross revenue, but the net revenues have remained essentially flat. Now we have, as Senator Johnson pointed out, about a 40% difference between the gross and net. And I'm just wondering, does that represent the spirit of the fiduciary responsibility we have to get the monies that are generated from the trust fund into the trust fund? And what is the reason for that flat net revenue and growth in the gross, and why would the management of those lands require such a significant portion of the total to facilitate that those revenues?
Mr. Chair, Senator, part of the reason is, as I mentioned, in the past, all mineral management costs were paid by the state's general fund. And in the biennium of 06 and 07, that was the year, those are the years where that was changed. And so for those 2 years, really for the first time ever, the mineral management costs were coming out of the net income, or out of the income from the trust fund. So that's part of it. And I think for fiscal 07, and perhaps Dave can help me with that, I believe the certified costs were higher for that year. And the reason is because of the fires. So some of the cost of fighting those fires went to the mineral, went to forestry costs, and also the stumpage value was down. And so those two things, I think, made a difference for that particular
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Battis, I appreciate that. Sorry. I understand your point. I just am, and I don't have familiarity with all the mechanics or the standards for trust management, but it just seems to me that a 40% management cost of a fund is high, regardless of the changes and so forth. That seems to me to be extraordinarily high. And I don't know if it is or not. As I said, I don't know how this compares to other kinds of trusts, but it would seem to me that that would be an issue that we should focus on, is to say there should be a larger percentage of that gross that actually ends up for the purpose for which it was designated. And we understand that there's cost to management, but 40% of the gross seems high. And I don't know what the what goes into those costs, but I think that's something that I personally would like to see change so that you have a substantially larger percentage that are actually ending up in the purpose for which it was designated. And I don't know if you have any comment on that, whether this is traditional or if this is the expected standard, but from my relatively inexperienced perspective, that 40% management cost seems very high.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, to that point, I believe you said that was changed in the last 6 or 7 legislature. So that was an act of the legislature. We're trustees. So we decided that that shouldn't come out of the general fund, that we'd create this management fund. So I think you're right. We ought to be at least looking at the amount. We perhaps ought to be looking at the decision as to whether that really was representative of trustee, to what extent that fund should have that responsibility. I'd also just raise one other issue. Is there any potential for any of the land exchanges of getting them into the lands generating mineral revenue, exchanging for mineral rights? Because that's where the money is right now.
Mr. Chair, constitutionally, it's prohibited to exchange trust fund mineral rights. Cannot sell or trade them.
To trust fund ones.
Right.
But can you trade land that's not generating any and getting more mineral rights with it that could generate?
Mr. Chair, the answer to that question is yes. That's possible.
There are acreages available that could be where that could be done. Under state ownership.
It's possible.
Okay.
Senator Salzman.
Go for it. On all these points, Mr. Chair, and especially to Senator Hand, for those of us who went on this tour, it was a great opportunity. We never really get to explore some of these areas, but I think what comes down here too is that these funds. What is the incentive to raise additional funds, because they essentially, as my understanding, roll in, is that it's sort of like we never really see them. And if they were in a standalone account that could be used for a specific purpose, and that's what we saw as happening in other states, we would be keeping a better eye on how much money is being generated from this fund, because it's my understanding, again, that the revenue replaces general fund money. So, in other words, we're not making the general fund support this, and yet the general fund benefits whatever comes out of this. So, I mean, it's sort of an interesting, but I think that's where this discussion may go, is should it be a separate fund that funds a specific, and I see that's on the agenda today. I know Senator Lynch and I had this discussion during the tour, and I think the School Board Association did also, because these funds should be, you know, really doing something very special. And if we could watch them, we'd be a little bit more on top of it.
Go to Senator Lynch, and then we'll ask the department to sum up and then go to Ms. Schwab's testimony. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Saltzman, to that point, and I asked counsel to check my figure here, but I believe that it was up until 1988 that there was, in fact, a separate fund. As you are indicating. And it was in 1988, based on a decision made at that time by the legislature, that though these permanent school trust fund proceeds, in essence, were rolled into the general education formula. And I would suggest that you might see some work in that area during this next session. If I could, Mr. Chair, just make a follow-up comment. I see that there's this permanent school fund advisory committee, and my recollection is that it's a relatively small membership, but there are representatives of the legislature that are on that advisory committee. And so would it be under the purview of that committee? For example, Senator Olson made some very valuable and pertinent comments about the water access sites that don't, you know, some of which are have revenue-generating mechanisms and some that don't. Would that be something that this advisory committee might be looking at in terms of recommendations and policy and that kind of thing?
Yes. Okay. If we could get a summary and then go to Ms. Schwab.
If I could just say, again, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about this topic. And, you know, one thing that was raised and certainly is one that we'd be happy to work with you is the management costs that we have associated with these lands. And I can tell you during the legislative session on the mineral side, no one really questioned that you needed to do that kind of work. The question was, how should you pay for it? And that's a fair question. And I can tell you that that experience from many of the western states, really all but one of the western states that I'm aware of, the management costs are funded out of the income from the trust fund. It's just how they operate. And how that compares on a percentage basis, I don't know. But that would be the kind of information perhaps we could work on over the next few months. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you. In 2004, it is my understanding that there was a resolution to memorialize the Minnesota Congressional Delegation.
You've got one unused mic that's waiting behind
to increase a portion of the fee for the Boundary Water Canoe Area for that 800 acres that sits in there now. Whatever happened with that, and has there been any further discussion since 2004?
Madam Chair, a great deal of discussion. It has been no fee increase to compensate the school trust fund for the use of the 84,000 acres that are in the Boundary Waters. There was a letter sent by the Commissioner of DNR to the Forest Service requesting an exchange of those lands and or a portion of those lands to get it started. And the Forest Service did respond to that, saying that in order to accomplish that, they would need to do environmental review on all of the lands that would be exchanged, plus all of the lands the Forest Service would give up. Plus, they didn't have any money to work on that. So that was the response back to the request to start an exchange process for those lands.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And this leads me to the question that I did ask up north, too. First of all, I have to piggyback on what Senator Hahn said, is that, you know, I think there's a 47% expenses on the forestry side of that. And there is some way we need to get our arms around that. We need to have a very careful assessment as to whether or not an investment should have that much of an overhead or administrative expenses. And so thank you for bringing that up so eloquently. The question that I asked up north is I am still a little bit confused about who is the person at the DNR that is responsible for follow-up on the 2004 discussion of the Boundary Waters Canoe and reporting back to us or whomever the agency might be. Who is the person who is out there making sure that these funds, that the we are reducing the expenses and that the funds are being maximized?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I think the answer is all the statutes name the Commissioner of Natural Resources as the person responsible, and we all work to support the Commissioner.
Great.
There are many people within DNR that are working on those kinds of topics.
So there is no one person that is hired and charged with maximizing the revenue in reducing the expenses and looking out for the school district, that their primary mission is to be looking out for the schools?
Madam Chair, I think if you look at the biennial budget for example, the Division of Lands and Minerals, the fiduciary responsibility of the school trust fund is the first thing that's always named in what it is that we intended to do. We have a very, very long history of trying to generate income to follow that direction of the state statute to maximize the return to the trust fund. If I could just mention, if you understand, we also have responsibility for other classifications of land. And so, for example, when we do mineral leasing, it's a patchwork of ownerships. And so we're working on a number of different kinds of land that we're leasing to try to get revenue. One of them is school trust fund, and that is the one class of land where we have that direction to get economic return for the trust.
Mr. Chair, I'm just really trying to listen, but I'm not sure if I heard the answer to Representative Dietrich's question, and I think you raise a very critical question. So I hesitate to restate your question, but I think you are asking who is responsible for the oversight of these permanent school trust fund lands within that agency?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, the one individual, or I'm wondering who works on this, because you know we have the people that are supported by the mineral management account and they work on the mineral aspects. There are forestry people that put time towards this management effort. I'd like to answer the question. I'm not sure I'm understanding what it is. DNR does not have individuals that are dedicated exclusively only to work on school trust fund land, except to say that we did recently hire a person to work just on that issue of trying to sort out where there are management units that won't allow generation of income. Did hire someone specifically to look at that topic and to come up with that plan.
Do you have any response? You can follow up with that.
Open this trust.
I did read that you did recently hire somebody. So in that instance, is that person then reimbursed through the school land revenue? Is his salary paid by the school land revenue, or does that come out of a DNR expense?
Madam Chair, that person is going to be paid for 6 months by the Division of Forestry, and I'm not sure what the source of funding is. And after that, we would intend to continue that person on for some period of time until that task is done. And that would likely be a combination of funding sources. I'm informed that for the forestry portion of it, that would be general fund.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just very, very quickly, I guess to make a recommendation to the committee. I don't know who is on the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee, and frankly, I'm not even familiar with what they do, but maybe we need to get some joint effort with that group to find out what kind of oversight is being applied to the trust fund, and that might be something that this committee could spur along. And the second thing is that maybe we need to ask the department to give us a more detailed accounting of the $14 million in management costs that are the difference between the gross and the net in the last fiscal period, so that we understand better what those management costs are. And maybe we could ask for that as a specific informational request, that we get that broken out in some detail.
Yeah.
I think Mr. Melman can just give you the statutory site, and Representative Mariani and I are members, and I think chair of this committee. Last year,
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, it's a pleasure to be with you. My name is Grace Schwab, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent every school district in the state of Minnesota. This was one of the key issues my organization wanted to bring forward this legislative session, and we really applaud Chairman Wieger and Chairwoman Dietrich's commitment to this issue and everyone else that went on this lands tour. My organization would like to see those school trust fund land revenue that presently just sort of passes through education on the way to the state's general fund to be actually sent toward the school funds. In particular, it could fund things like technology, which, if you remember correctly from last session, we've only funded for 2 years. This would be a way to direct
that, Mike.
This would be a way to direct that money into a specific account for children across the state of Minnesota. So we encourage that. Also, the other piece we'd like to see, and I think you hit on the $14 million in cost, we have real concerns about the management or challenges facing management of these kinds of lands as we go forward, and we'd like the legislature to help scrutinize this effort forward and enhance it. And I think as school districts start to see these dollars come home to actual students, we'll start to see more and more interest in this whole area. So I appreciate the time today and look forward to working with you as we go forward.
Thank you. Questions? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on this issue? Any suggestions
or observations? Representative Dietrich.
Yes, I would like to, if I think any one of the three testifiers could answer this question, but would one of you touch on the New Mexico model as to how they handle the school trust fund? Was that the video we saw?
Is that Utah?
Utah, thank you.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, I could take a crack at that. I don't claim to be an expert on this topic, but Utah did make a change. I'm thinking it was 10 or 15 years ago on how these lands were managed. And they, Utah, they set up a separate permanent school fund land department. And the purpose of that department is to manage those lands. And 100% of their costs for doing that come from the proceeds from the school fund. And in fact, if you take a look at Western states, there are, I believe it's 5 elected land commissioners that oversee school lands. There are a number of states that have a board that people report to that work in those departments. And there are some that have their management done through a department like DNR. So there's no one model. It's a variety of ways that that land is managed. But Utah does have a separate trust land department.
Mr. Chairman, I also want to share Texas and Arizona also have very strong school funds that almost actually pay for their entire educational systems and really bring a lot to the table. So certainly with good management principles, to shoot higher isn't out of the realm of possibility. The other thing that I encourage members to look at is if the university has a set of trust lands, as does the school lands, and there seems to be not a lot of difference in revenue generation from either one, but a huge difference. The university has 25,000 acres. We have 2.5 million acres. There's not that proportion of scale we see. So that might be just another avenue you want to address as you go forward.
Mr. Chair, if I might mention,
yes,
there are some Western states that make a tremendous income from their school lands, and it's those states with energy. New Mexico, for example, last year took in $500 million worth of income, and almost all of it was from oil and gas revenues. And so we have what we have. I've heard it suggested we ought to figure an ankle drilling program where we start in Minnesota and drill under Texas and get that oil revenue here, but they have oil.
Members, I did ask Eric Naumann to put together some thoughts on the subject as well, and that's in part based on some of your reflections and Representative Dietrich. And I'd like Eric Naumann to just highlight some of the points that are made in handouts that you have at the table on a discussion draft that will be further discussed next month.
Mr. Chairman, members, Eric Naumann with Senate Fiscal. Good to see all your faces again. Mr. Chairman and I guess Madam Chair, both, this is a joint hearing, correct? I'm looking at two drafts, which I think you have in front of you, one of which I had some responsibility for, and then the other came from the Senate Environment Committee staff. I'm looking at the first one, coded 08-4791, which I think is the more clean education draft, What this does, I'm going to talk about Section 2 first, is repeal the subtraction from the under current law. I think members are probably intimately familiar with this now. Any revenue generated off the permanent school fund is credited to the schools, and then an equal amount gets subtracted off of the general education formula. Not the formula line itself, but the broad category of general education. So if it generates $22 million in permanent school funds in a given year, we're going to there would be an equal subtraction off of current law, off of general education. And Section 2 repeals that subtraction. So what that would mean is that general education would grow by $22 million because we would no longer make that subtraction. Section 1 of the bill dedicates the money that is generated from the permanent school fund to be used for technology purposes. Just straight up. So that money, which is currently used for basically general education purposes, would then get reallocated for technology purposes, and then the lack of subtraction would replace the general money that school districts are getting off the permanent school fund. So there's kind of two pieces to that transaction.
Okay. Questions on the draft, Senator Hinn?
Just one question. I think that this is something we ought to take a look at. I think that we ought to consider repealing the 2006 statute. I'm a little concerned why we'd want to, at the legislative level, designate the use of the funds. Why would we not want to let the funds flow to the school districts as part of their general fund and let them decide where to use those? And why would we want to designate them just for technological or, I mean, if you have a district that has a large technology levy, for example, this may end up being funds that are beyond what they really need. I just wonder why we'd want to designate that. Is that
Senator Hann, Eric Nauman was just doing that. He was asked to put together some thoughts, so I'll take the blame as to technology, and thought that ideally we could ask each district to decide. But what I was impressed when I saw the Utah example was that people saw how that money was being invested. There was a program, a face on it. And in our meetings across the state, the needs of technology keep coming up. And I don't think we've met those needs in any district. And so that was the purpose there. And Mr. Nauman was just reflecting what we had talked about. And I believe Representative Dietrich, too, has talked to some members about this in the other body. Just this has been a lot of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to just comment on that. In the area of education, we all, you know, accept the fact that technology has become is just like the textbooks. We need it, and that need is going to continue to grow. And at this time, there at least the people in my school district have asked for some sort of revenue stream for technology, so that they can demonstrate to the public what they are spending their money on and how technology is benefiting the school district, and have something to point to. So they have been asking for a dedicated revenue stream for technology for quite some time. And when it's very difficult to find something that applies to every single school district. And so when this topic started came up, I kind of thought to myself, what is one need that is a need from every single school district in the state? And that is going to be also a need into the future, and so this is how we somewhat landed on that.
Mr. and Madam Chair, we could probably accomplish that rather than making it that specific. Of if you had a designated source of money that they are getting, and indicating that it has to be made public how they are going to use that money, for other than not pouring into just basic operational things. So in other words, what they'll do to improve the instruction or the resources available using that money. And let you could give some flexibility there, but I would suspect that that's probably where it would go in most cases. But it would be their decision.
And I think the intent is that the districts capture the money.
Yeah.
That it not just be a pass-through, which I think is so disingenuous to the Constitution intent for having these funds go for schools.
Whatever was done in 1988 was...
Mr. Chairman.
Senator John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to reiterate the option for flexibility. Representative Dietrich pointed to a specific technology, but there's a strong transportation need in that same district. So I think the flexibility issue should be a component.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Nauman. Further thoughts on this subject? It's very helpful. And Representative Dietrich, you have a working group that's going to be meeting over the next few weeks to look at this, and we invite responses to this and other suggestions as we've done today, but it's our intent to advance this during the 08 session. Now, Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I wonder if Representative Dietrich would, could you just indicate for us who the members are that are working on your subcommittee?
Yes. Representative Garofalo, Representative Erickson, and Representative Brown, and myself.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, and thank you again, Representative Dietrich, for joining us today.
I apologize for being late.
And members, thank you for your participation. This committee's adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.